Light Pollution with Bill McGinney on episode 412, the Actual Astronomy Podcast. I'm Chris, and joining me is Shane. We are amateur astronomers who love looking up the night sky, and this podcast is for everybody who enjoys going out under the stars. Shane, do you want to read the bio, or do you want me to read the bio this week?
Go ahead, Chris. I don't want to disrupt our routine. Who knows what will happen then?
Yeah, exactly. All right. I'll read the bio first, and then we will jump into the conversation. Bill McGinney is the host of the Light Pollution News podcast. People should look that up. He is an amateur astronomer, an astrophotographer, and a starry sky advocate. Bill is past president of the Delaware Valley Amateur Astronomers. Bill also volunteered as a master watershed steward in Philadelphia County and as a crew leader for the Friends of the Wissanakon. In addition, enjoys birding. That's close to it. Okay, good stuff. In addition, enjoys birding and is an avid bike rider. In a past life, Bill was a beer brewery owner and a certified beer judge. Bill currently lives in Philadelphia, attempting astrophotography under the bright Bortle 8 skies there. Welcome to the show, Bill. Great to have you.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
I gotta ask, though,
Wissahickon. Yep. A lot of the names around Philadelphia are native names.
Awesome. So this is the gorge I think you were telling us about in the...
Yes, that's right. The Wissahickon Gorge. I grew up near the Perkiomen Creek, and we have these, which is a Dutch name here, which I still have struggled to spell, but the main river here, the Schuylkill River, I think it took me about 25 years to learn how to actually fully spell that. But
and what did you do as a master watershed steward?
So what we do is we try and raise awareness on essentially how to handle issues dealing with watershed. So that includes point source pollution, non-point source pollution, which is essentially saying how to create a better water ecosystem, how to handle stormwater runoff and stormwater drainage, and also how to raise awareness of individuals' impacts on the watershed itself. So it's a lot of things I specifically do is like I'll do hikes looking at the water infrastructure and trying to point out things that people pass on a daily basis that they don't even realize is there and what it's doing and how it's actually reducing their water bill, stuff like that. Where because the more we can have better quality going in, the less we have to worry about, you know, having machinery and the mechanisms on the outside. And then you also can restore some of these streams to have some of the ecology come back.
Mm. I was listening to Quirks and Quirks, which is the CBC Canadian Science podcast.
That's a great show.
Yeah, they were actually talking about like the damage that human activities are doing to groundwater this week. So yeah, I was just listening to that yesterday. So very timely. So maybe we'll just hop into some of this stuff. Shane, do you want to go for it?
Yeah. So Bill, in our collaboration leading up to the show, you mentioned some 100mm binoculars and in addition to just being an advocate for preserving night skies, you get out and you do some amateur astronomy, and just curious about what other gear you have for visual observing and how you like those 100mm binoculars. I'm very curious about potentially getting something like a 100mm binoscope. So very interested in what you think of that stuff.
Yeah. So the club that I'm with, the Delaware Valley Amateur Astronomers, we're a pretty sizable club in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania region. And we have a auction every couple of years, every few years. And that auction, you can buy really good stuff for absolutely nothing. So I knew this would be the only time in my life I'll be able to afford binoculars, because they usually run $3,000, $4,000, you know, upwards. And these are Oberwerks that were actually used in communist Germany and China for military purposes. And then they started manufacturing them, just, I guess they had leftovers or whatever they're manufacturing them for. I guess the U.S. used some of them in Iraq. But we had a member who was getting rid of them. So I paid like, I don't know, it was the only time my life was going to be able to get them. So I paid like $150 and got these amazing binos that are 25X to 45X and they're 100 millimeters. And I've used them a handful of times and I've only had them since, I want to say, like December, January. So I haven't been able to get out with them. They're not really good for light polluted areas, but they're really good in dark sky areas. And I was able to get out once up to to Cherry Springs, which I think is a Bortle 2. And up there, it was spectacular. It was everything I wanted it to be. And it's there's something innately fun about having gigantic binoculars.
I bet. Are those eyepieces fixed, or can you do you swap out the eyepieces in this one?
That's a good question because these aren't astronomy binoculars, and I think the main reason is because the eyepieces are fixed, so it gives you a preset. So again, you have like your wide, your 40, and then your 25 to kind of bring it in. So you know it's not you can't just pop in new eyepieces for it. So
yeah. Yeah, yeah. And have you been able to compare the views through 100 millimeter binos to just like, say, 100 millimeter monoscope, a telescope?
Yeah. So in addition to the binos, I have a 12-inch Dob that I've had for years, a nice. Skywatcher. It's great. I love it. And that's kind of where I started out. And I have an 80 millimeter EDSF Vixen that I use for photography. Obviously I used to use it for regular observing, but then I started using it for photography once I started going down that route. And the difference is really the field of view, obviously, is the main difference. You have, you know, twice as much field of view as you would have in a normal telescope, depending on the lens you're actually putting on there. But the field of view is the main difference, and it's great for just really big objects. And that's where it's fun at. And I brought it to a star party, a public star party, because we do those about each month over here at a national park, Valley Forge. And, you know, it's one of those things where people can connect with the binos much easier than they can connect with a telescope.
Mm-hmm.
And you find a good object like the double cluster. You find a good object like M42. Like some of these big objects look spectacular in there. And those big, it's made for those objects. So you're not going to be able to split, you know, like you're not going to be able to split Sirius, what B in that, but it's still good for what it is. And, you know, I think I'm a firm believer that each piece of astronomy equipment, no matter how exorbitant and how mortgage affecting it may be, has its own specific strength, right? Its own specific purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm there with you on that one. As someone who just bought a 7-inch refractor,
yeah.
Well, and you know that's a great point, Bill. Like, there's really not one telescope to rule them all. You know, each instrument excels at certain things, and you know, it's nice to have a little bit of a collection so you can sort of pull out the right one for whatever you're doing, if it's public observing or something else. I like that a lot.
I was just looking at the newsletter for the for your Delaware astronomy group, and just scrolling through, I saw that Joe Lamb and his 12-inch F8 reflector, he wrote up a report from it, and that's one of the telescopes that Mark Radici was observing with and talking about on a recent show just last week. I don't know if that show's even come out yet, but
small world. Yeah, you mentioned Bill, you mentioned Cherry Springs, observing there, Bortle 2 Sky. Is that where you do most of your observing, or is it a different location where you end up doing the majority?
I do most of my observing from here, from home. Yeah. So, you know, like I can get, you know, in the wintertime, you can get out and you can look at stuff right after work or whatnot. So that's where I do most of my observing. I'll bring out the Dob. And like I was saying to you guys beforehand, I'm doing the Astrosim list, which really is a fun list for urban skies. It's something you can do for the most part in urban skies. There's some areas where you need darker skies, but for the most part, you can get a lot of stuff done just here in Bortle 8.
So is that the Astronomical League's Asterism?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
How many objects are on that?
Ooh. Oh, I don't know. So, I have a spreadsheet, but I don't have the number on it.
No worries. I'm just curious.
Yeah. I'll do that here. I'll do we try and get I try and get up to Cherry Springs. We the club I run the field trips for the club, so we try and get a cabin up there like 2 to 3 times a year. You know, and going up there, you're closer to Lake Erie and you're in a downwind part of it. So it's kind of a crapshoot, and especially in the wintertime, you really have to get lucky to have a clear night. Summertime isn't bad, but wintertime, it's you just don't know where you're going to get. So getting up there is a privilege. Otherwise, we have a Bortle 4 to 5 location that's about 45 minutes, an hour away. And I'll get over there as well. Get over there like maybe once a quarter. So that's fun.
Yeah, that's great. Any other dark sites that you've had the privilege to be able to observe under, just abroad or anywhere else?
About was it 2024? Whoo, time flies. I think the Astronomical League had Alcon back at Bryce Canyon in 2010.
Okay.
So I went there with some members of a club, and one guy brought out his, I want to say it was a 15-inch Dob. He brought out his Dob, and we set that up at the end because they allowed public viewing at the end of Rainbow Point, and we're stargazing right there in Bryce Canyon, which that was spectacular. That was probably one of my favorite nights ever stargazing.
Well, that's amazing. I love talking to US guests on our show and hearing about some of these different dark sky locations, because there's a lot of them in your country, but also it's, some of them are relatively accessible for Chris and I. So I, selfishly build a little bit of a list of potential destinations of places to
Well,
go and observe.
Cherry Springs is interesting because it's in a way it's so close to so many urban areas. So just for like if you talk about hours, it's about 6 hours in every 6 to I don't know 8 hours in every direction. So Philadelphia, New York, Buffalo. I don't know how far it is Toronto, maybe 9 hours from Toronto. You do get a lot of people who are in Southern Ontario who cross and swing on down. Cleveland, Pittsburgh, you know, you're within range of all of these urban centers, and it's relatively easy to get to. So, you know, for us, it's a blessing, and hopefully we can keep preserving it. You never know. But
Yeah,
I think it
for
was,
sure.
I think it was about 4 hours from Kitchener-Waterloo. They were just kind of getting it online because I lived there from 2006 to 2009-ish. And yeah, they were just starting to talk about Cherry Springs during that period of time, but it wasn't set up or there wasn't anything there. So if you went down, you were, I think it was sort of like just a small park at that time, and there wasn't any like restrictions for white lights. So sometimes people would go and it'd be awesome, and then sometimes people would go and there'd be like three campers set up with generators and spotlights in the field. So
oh,
I
wow.
was reluctant to head down at that point in time.
Yeah. Oh,
Good
it's
thing.
better now.
Yeah, I was gonna say, good thing it's evolved.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a good segue here, Bill. It takes a lot of effort to produce a podcast and, the YouTube channel, all of that stuff. And this is what you do. Light pollution news is something, that's very near and dear to Chris and I's heart, and I think most astronomers. But why are you so passionate about preserving dark skies?
So I guess I'll try and truncate this story a little bit. Pre-pandemic, you know, I knew that just like you guys, dark skies, I always associated with astronomy. That was what I always thought of it as. It's like, you know, it's just a nuisance for astronomers. It is what it is, but like, you know, it's just pain in the butt for astronomers. That's all it is. Just a bunch of astronomers complaining about skies being too bright. Pandemic comes along. You know, I started going down a rabbit hole and start reading Paul Bogard's book and start reading some other books. And you know, you're in lockdown, so you're looking at life differently. And coming post-pandemic, my view totally changed in that light pollution really had nothing to do. I mean, it does have a lot to do with astronomy, but that's really not the problem. The problem is it's a actual environmental pollutant. And It's an environmental pollutant that changes the behavior, activity, and the actual composition of the environment that it's affecting. So maybe in small doses, it wouldn't have been such an issue. But now, since we light up everything to such an nth degree, you can go, I don't know how it is for you guys, but I can go anywhere around here, and apartment complexes are lit up brighter than Citizens Bank Park, which is where, you know, the Philadelphia Phillies play. And it's not a joke. It is, you know, you have blinding lights everywhere, and that's changing the behavior of everything that exists in those blinding lights. So I learned that it was a ecological issue, and that kind of raised my eyebrow, man. I was like, you know what? There's something here. We're actually losing night. If you look out at night here in Philadelphia, we do not have darkness. We have, on clear skies, it will be a little bit dark. It's not like a blue. It's a blue sky. You can count about 150 stars from where I'm at. You go downtown, it's about 54. But on a cloudy night, it's as bright as the full moon. It never gets dark. And we don't, as people, we don't even think about it, because what we do is we go inside, close the shade, light every single thing we can possibly find, light it up, and then go to bed. And some of it's for aesthetics. Some of it's because we're paranoid. Some of it might be justified because you have someone coming home late, you know, they want to be able to see how they're getting in and stuff like that. But so much of it is just light that has no purpose. And it affects everything. So that's how I started really going down the hole. And when I was trying to learn about it, I joined the Dark Sky International and was trying to like understand it. And I was thinking, you know, is this real? Is this something that, you know, is just like a creed? Is there like a religion, or is it actually a problem? And the more I dug into it, the more I realized it's actually a problem. It's not, you know, it's not something that you can just say, oh, you know, dark skies are healthier for the environment. It is. There's plenty of research out there. There's a ton of research out there. And that's where I decided, you know, I was like, when I was trying to go down that hole, I didn't come across any place that would give me the information to make me feel confident in a city where we have supposedly high crime rates, where we have people who, you know, we're switching over to LEDs, and we had an initial push to have 4,000 Kelvin LEDs all over the place and make everything super bright. You couldn't make conversation based on knowledge I had obtained from Dark Skies. Not saying Dark Sky doesn't do a good job. They do a great job trying to educate everyone. But I knew I needed to dig deeper, and that's when I started podcasts, because that would give me light pollution news is simply a discussion on the news in light pollution, or affecting light pollution, or things are in and around the topic of light pollution each month. And there's a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And I hope it helps people to discern and understand and create conversation where it needs to be had.
Yeah. I still remember. So, you know, as a amateur astronomer now for 21 years, like seriously observing with, you know, an 8-inch Dobsonian as my first telescope, you know, the light pollution awareness that I gained early on was I only observed from our city in the backyard. And I was working on the Messier list and had probably completed, I bet, half the list. M31 was sort of fresh. I had just observed it, the Andromeda Galaxy, and I was amazed from my backyard at what I saw, this giant galaxy. Oh my gosh, you know, it was wonderful. And then I finally went out to a dark site about 30 or so minutes outside of our city, Regina, to the Astronomy Club's dark site, and looked at Andromeda with the same telescope, and it wasn't the same galaxy, you know, like yeah. It was the same galaxy, but the view was so different under a dark sky. It blew my mind. Just the impact that light pollution had on my views completely changed how I observed. You know, I no longer would look at deep sky objects from the backyard anymore, other than like open clusters and kind of double stars, because it just wasn't worth it to me. However, my knowledge of light pollution and its impact was just that. Like you had mentioned, Bill, you know, it's a pain in my butt as an astronomer, turn off your lights, you know? And then, you know, Chris has been instrumental in helping establish some dark sky preserves here in our province. But there's also another fairly strong advocate named Richard Husiak, who we've had on the show. And I think he talked about light pollution too in one of the episodes.
Yeah.
But I remember the first time he gave a presentation at a public event about light pollution. And it blew my mind of the stuff that you just referred to, Bill, of the, like, astronomy is just one little part of the negative impacts of light pollution on the environment. And it really opened my eyes to the impacts on, you know, migration patterns, impacts just on our human health, animal health. Like, there's so much. It just, it really, really surprised me. And, you know, as such, whenever we have an opportunity on this podcast to talk about it and bring more awareness to it, I think it's super valuable because it goes far beyond astronomy. But, you know, I don't know if there's like multiple sort of perspectives or definitions of light pollution, but what would you say, like, how do you define light pollution? Is it just unnecessary light, or how do you like to put words around that?
I think that was a problem with light pollution for a long time. And there's a great study. There was two major research, I guess, journals last year that had light pollution front and center. First was Science in July, and then was the Royal Transactions, hold on, Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B, which is the, I think that's more of the ecological, biological sciences. I could be wrong on that. Anyway, they led their light pollution, essentially a light pollution compendium, this one journal. They led it with a really interesting article that I think I personally use because I think it makes more sense. And they said that light itself, artificial light at night itself, is a pollutant. And when you start thinking of it from that framework, everything falls into place. It's why we squint when we have super bright lights at night, or why we get a headache when we're in super bright lit areas at night. It's why the bugs are constantly flying to the light, or why you have bird collisions, right? It's why, you know, we witness strange behavior in mammals, like foxes will be hunting during the day and, you know, they just become adapted to the night, or I'm sorry, adapted to artificial light at night. Mm-hmm. The coming at it from that perspective makes much more sense. And in addition, it kind of guides the hand a lot better on how to use light. Because once you realize that artificial light at night itself is a pollutant, and then you can make better decisions, better policies with how you use light during the night.
Yeah, no, I love that.
It's interesting that you mentioned policy, because I studied public policy at school. And when I was studying that, I was taking this class on finance, and they were using as an example of a positive good for society was the fact that streetlights are too bright and sometimes shine in people's yards and spill over into areas that they're not supposed to, as a benefit to everybody. And I was like, no, raising my hand. That's not good. This is a bad thing. And I remember the professor was so mad at me. But it's one of those things where it's just like nobody questions it. It's just automatically assumed. Like every single person in that class was following along with that example. And the danger of that, like you're thinking, well, this is just a class at university, a bunch of eggheads or whatever. Well, all these people go off and they are all like senior policy analysts in governments throughout like our country. And like if they wander off believing this, then it's very difficult to overcome like basically what they were even like specifically taught in school. Like definitely it's one of those things. You know, sort of speaking of school, I looked up Paul Bogard's book. I had recalled that I haven't read it myself, but I know we have a lot of people that are into books, but that's The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. And I put the Amazon link there in case people want to pick that up. But that looks like a great book. Thanks for recommending it, Bill.
And I would recommend one more. There's a new one that came out, Dani Robertson, All Through the Night. I actually just had her on Light Pollution News. And that's a relatable one, because I think, Chris, you mentioned something there that is kind of like is the elephant in the room. You can talk rationally about light at night, but light at night isn't rational. We're very primal creatures in that we are terrified of night. Like we are just, that's what our DNA is. We are terrified of the darkness. We're terrified of night, regardless if that makes sense. And that's one of the areas. If you understand that that's really what's the driving force behind many people, you can then be able to kind of broach conversation a little better with them. You know, and you can come again, you understand it. Artificial light itself is a pollutant, and that people are just typically not comfortable when it's not bright.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Like even when I'm out observing and I'm driving back into the city, like even when I see that city glow, like there is like a palpable sense of relief when you see those lights at night.
Yeah.
You do get that sense that everything is going to be okay.
Well, and they're, you know, even when I'm out observing and sometimes it's by myself, sometimes it's with Chris or others, I can relate, you know, if there's a wooded area near us, well, I can't see it, you know, I can't see what's there. And you know, you start to, your mind starts to dance a little bit. So
go check it out, Shane.
Yeah, that's right.
We'll be right here.
I love the noises at night. I might be a little, as a kid, I used to go out at all time at night, and you know, initially with a 4.5-inch reflector telescope, and I'd be happy to stay out all night. But it cracked me up the other night. I was observing in Cherry Springs, and it was foggy, and it was this low level fog, so you could see the winter Milky Way perfectly. It was a spectacular night, but where you're at, like right up to my head, it was pretty foggy, and you could hear a fox cry. And I don't know if you guys, I'm sure you guys have heard foxes cry. Mm-hmm. And it can terrify anyone who isn't aware of what that is.
They sound so weird.
And this guy was going around the perimeter of the yard, and he was doing it over the course of, I don't know, 20 minutes. And it just make you jump each time. but I love the sound. We had a location north of here about 3 hours that had coyotes, and you know, you're out there and you hear the coyotes, and you know a coyote's not going to take you down, but it's fun to hear the sounds.
Yeah,
but you might need some thicker skin. I think some people might need some thicker skin to be able to hang out in some of that.
For sure.
Yeah, our coyotes out where my place is, they come right up right into my yard, like, and it's so loud when they start howling, like in my, like they're only like 20 or 30 feet from where I'm sleeping inside, and it's incredibly loud. But we got a lot more, we have a lot of animals out here, Bill. You should come out sometime and experience it. It's pretty wild stuff. The deer come crashing through the woods right behind you, and yeah, there's all kinds of different things out here for sure, like cougars and stuff. That's always sort of makes you have a heightened level of awareness when you're out there.
Right. Yeah, no, it sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you got Portal One skies.
It's dark. Yeah. I mean, that's like what it boils down to, is that where you have those dark skies is where you're going to have definitely a lot more animals than that around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very cool. I put that link for Dani Robertson's book in here as well, All Through the Night. That looks pretty good as well. So, yeah, I'm going to have to pick up a couple of these. That's One Woman's Fight to Protect Our Planet's Nature and Environment from the Effects of Light Pollution. Awesome.
And Dani speaks to something in there that I think is really important, because women have a lot more difficulty with this topic, I think, and men. And it's because, I really think it's because of society. I think society kind of leans into always telling women to be terrified, and that, you know, someone's going to come out and get you. And, you know, it's, there's a lot of, you know, bad men out there who are gonna to find you and do stuff. And you know, I'm not gonna say that there aren't horrific crimes, and they're not all pretty much all committed by guys. But we do a lot to make women feel incredibly uncomfortable at night. And Danny presents a pretty good view on it. Danny speaks to that. And I think that's the first time I've heard it in any of these type of books. So
good plug. Sounds interesting.
I remember I was talking to a female amateur astronomer, and she basically said, coming out with you and your friends, like doing everything my mother told me not to do, which is to go out somewhere dark, hang out with a bunch of strange, odd men in the dark, and try to have a good time. This is a bad idea, generally speaking.
Yep.
Mm-hmm, always think about that.
Yeah. Bill, do you ever find, you know, as an advocate for dark skies and preventing light pollution, do you ever feel like it's pushing a rope up a hill type of battle? You know, do you see the gains? Do you get frustrated sometimes with the challenges associated with it?
You know, when you're doing any kind of advocacy, you're pushing a rope up a hill. But we can look at this multiple ways. First, if we're trying to preserve night, and we really are serious about it, then the more people who can speak up can lessen the burden of that person pushing that rope up the hill. The more you can reach out to your elected official, the more you can question the decisions that you're making, the more you can ask for different kind of fixtures at your local hardware store. The more others step up, the less burdensome it is to go up that hill. And we can say, you know, it's so hard, it's impossible, no one here is going to do that. During COVID, I saw things change I thought I'd never see change, right? Like, we had this whole movement, regardless of your view on it, we had this whole movement on diversity and inclusion that was revolutionary. And it really set the tone for many, the ways many businesses approached, you know, many of their practices. It changed stuff. So we can do this. We got this. But we need to step up together and start making our voice more prominent and start questioning just the basic assumptions that we have in our normal consumerism and in our town's decisions. There's an article I'm going to talk about. Actually, I'm recording the April show right after this in a couple hours. And there's an article I came across for Grand Rapids. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, they switched over to 4,000K LEDs. And they were like, this is what we want to do. It's great. It's going to be brighten up the whole city. It's going to be phenomenal. And the residents were like, whoa, my neighborhood looks like it's, you know, sunlight out there. And when you look at the details, Grand Rapids put surveys out there, and a fraction, like 36 people actually responded to the surveys. And those 36 people, well, the majority of them said they wanted warmer colors and whatnot, but 36 people responded to the surveys. So the town's like, well, you know what? We can get this problem. They probably thought this, and I'm obviously making a big assumption here, but they probably thought this, hey, got a great deal on these 4,000K fixtures. Let's just do that. And only 36 people cared to respond. So we can do this. Mm-hmm. This isn't hopeless. You already see many communities, you know, here in Philly, we had essentially like a rebellion from a really rich area of the city when they got these 4,000K streetlights. And the city is now putting in warmer 3,000 or less streetlights in different areas. And it's going in many parts of the city. It's happening. Now, there's plenty of practices that are still not great here, but that's one of them. Another one is, again, during COVID 2019, we had a major bird kill. And I'm sure, have you guys heard of Comcast?
Yes.
Yeah. Out there? Yeah. We're like the home base for Comcast, and Comcast has this glowing godforsaken light stick that they put up. It looks like it just is like a glow stick that can be seen for miles. So and I forget how many thousands died there, but in one night, I think it was like 2,000 that died at this glow stick. And a bird group, I don't know which one, we have multiple bird groups here. What they do is they do basic assessments for bird kills, and they keep all this data. And then they went to Comcast, or they went to some big players in the city and were like, you know, hey, we had a lot of birds that died. And we think it's because of the light. And they had a connection in that reached out to the president of Comcast, and Comcast didn't want to look like they were killing a whole bunch of birds. So we started this lights out campaign here, which during bird migration season, which is two parts of the year, and this time of year for about a month, and then in the fall for about a month, the big buildings will actually dim down from 12 to 4 in the morning. Granted, it's in my mind, that's not enough, but at the same time, that's a great start. Mm-hmm. Making awareness that light actually affects living creatures and light actually affects behavior. And that was huge. Huge. They got more than they could have ever wanted with that, you know, and we can do this. The other thing too, I'd say, is that example shows you how good having data is, and the use of SQM and the use of just any kind of light capturing device is going to be helpful. If you can track that, if you can actually make the case and be like, hey, you know what, light, it's getting brighter here, and we think it's from this building over here, or this, you know, this development over here, you know, we are actually seeing numbers increase and stuff. You have firm data. It's not always going to win a case. You still have to go out there and present the materials, but it's better than not having data. And that is how the bird groups have been successful, is with data. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So this is the SQM. This is the Unihedron device thing that you're referring to. Out of curiosity, Bill, is there like some publications or anything of that nature that would contain such data, sort of pre-canned stuff from the scientific community, for example?
As in a localized collection?
Yeah, like localized, or even on a national or some sort of regional level. Like, is there a source for this type of thing?
Not that I'm aware of. That would be a great opportunity if anyone's listening and, you know, they want to really help out. I mean, that's an easy shoe-in, I think.
Yeah, because like just being around, like, because the thing that I'm noticing in the past few years, and really it is just the past few years more so than any other time before, is these little LED lights. And I say little, and I mean, they are quite small. A neighbor just down the hill from me at my cabin, this was, I guess, last autumn. Fortunately, they've shut this off, but they were trying to sell their place. They were doing some work, and they had a truck parked there, I think, with a lot of stuff in it. And so they were trying to make sure nobody broke in. So they went out and bought, and these got to be pretty cheap. It was only like the size of a handheld flashlight, just like a mag light. And they put that on the side of their place, one point at one way, one point at the other. You know, you'd be able to buy these sort of lights for years, and they were always annoying enough, but they turned that thing on, and holy smokes, it had to be like a million candle power. Like, I mean, the amount of light that came out of this tiny thing, it was literally just like the sun. Like, it lit up the entire hillside. Like, I mean, a huge hillside. And this thing was like probably like 100 meters away or more from me. And there are a few, like even across the valley, I can see like maybe five or six of these. People are just putting them up, and I'm like, whoa. Like, this is no longer just like, well, maybe you're going to impact like your property for sure, and maybe a few people, like, you know, that sort of abut your land, or maybe that have a straight line of sight to you that are pretty close by. I mean, some of these lights are miles away from me, and they are ridiculously bright, like, you know, five times brighter than Venus, for example. Like, even from a mile away, they're almost hard to even look at. This, like, to my mind, this can't even be safe. Just like, apart from night sky, all this other stuff, like, they are so unbelievably bright. Like, this can't even be safe to have installed. Like, I was talking to my builder, and he bought a small one and put it in a bag, and accidentally had turned it on, and he put the bag down by his door, and the, you know, 5 minutes later, the bag was smoking. And I'm just like blown away that, that people can just, sell these, you know, such bright, luminous, lights as well, that, probably must be hurting people, because there's no way that, a light that's so bright, it can catch stuff on fire, you know, should, wow, should be allowed to be sold. It's really wild.
I never heard of that one. That's terrifying.
Yeah. Like they're generating that much heat just from the light source. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. He was showing me, it was all melted up and everything, but I'd even seen like videos online where people are like frying an egg with them and stuff like that. It's just wild what's out there. Like, how do we combat this kind of level of light brightness, with these new LEDs that everybody seems to want to get? Everybody wants to move out into the country and then turn their place into a stadium. You know, I think it's, there's some sort of misalignment with people's ideas and ideals for what it's like to live in the country. It's really strange.
Yeah, it's that fear factor. They're all, I guess you have a lot of murders in the country, but anyway, that's a,
there's not many out here.
You know, that maybe that's a good sort of segue, Bill, you know, for giving some tips to folks for advocacy. What are some of the common, you know, beliefs that just aren't true about darkness and the need for light?
Yeah. So the first one is that what Chris is saying, that light has no impact, that light's safe, that, you know, you put it up, it doesn't do anything. It's fine. It's just a nice, benign way to, you know, to have your safety. And if you put it up all around the house as bright as humanly possible, there will never, ever, ever be any problems. I don't know. I'll ask you guys this. If you ever, I don't know how often, like, I mean, I live in a city here. So if you're walking down a street, would you feel safe during the daytime if someone's coming at you with a gun?
No.
No. Okay. Well, would I you, mean, my day job involves that sometimes, but that's another story.
At night, if you're under a street light, would you feel safe if someone's coming at you with a gun?
Negative.
Yeah.
Okay. And then in the dark, would you feel safe if someone's coming at you with a gun?
No.
Okay. So all across the board, what I'm hearing is that you guys will not feel safe if someone is coming at you with a gun. And that's pretty much like when we start going down the crime stats here and the crime stuff, it's a very gray area. And cities and politicians or planners will try and say, you know, we got this New York study where the Chicago crime labs showed that you can reduce crime by having really bright lights, especially with diesel powered lights in a neighborhood, and it will magically reduce crime. Maybe for that location, it may actually reduce crime as was found in that study, but there are other variables that probably tie along with that than just the lights. Mm-hmm. And lights are one piece of a giant puzzle. They're not the one that, it's not a silver bullet. It's not going to do anything magical. Lights would not prevent that criminal who has walking down the street with a gun to shoot you or mug you or do whatever they want. Lights aren't going to do that. Lights aren't going to magically dissolve that person. But we like to think and like to feel that lights will. There's that study I mentioned there just looks at impact in specific areas. It doesn't look to see if there's any associated crime changes. To my knowledge, if I recall the study, I don't believe it looks at any associated crime changes outside of those specific areas. Also, it's probably more showing stimulus change than it is a light change. And here in Philadelphia, I can tell you if you park under a light, I would not feel safe leaving my car under a street light, because then you can just look in it and you can just smash the window and take whatever you need. Smash and grabs happen all the time. We see that in any of the parking lots here, in daytime, you know, on a busy day, mm-hmm. Just glass everywhere. And so crime is another one where it's a very, we want a cheap and easy policy win. And that's where we bring in the lights. It's a very hard thing to solve. Crime is a very difficult, complex issue. Mm-hmm. And maybe lights are part of it. And I'm not going to discount that. But weaponizing lights, I question our use of weaponizing lights on in that situation. And then I also question the communities that seem to be recipients of those weaponized lights. Why is it acceptable to weaponize lights against them, but not wealthier communities? So,
you know what's interesting? I'm just thinking. Well, I don't mean to cut you off, Bill, but I'm just thinking while you're talking. Sorry. Finish your thought. But
no, it's fine. Yeah.
I was just thinking about you know the lack of positive benefits that I have. So the light really doesn't reduce crime. But then I was also thinking about traffic, for example, in traffic accidents. Because I was just one day I was bored. I don't know why I was looking at this, you know, someone who studies policy, like when are the most traffic accidents? Like when do these occur? You know, does having light on all your roads, like they've lit up our roads here. It's like completely ridiculous. Like you used to be able to just observe on the edge of the city. Now you have to go 23 miles away. So you're putting the lights below the horizon. But the most traffic accidents occur like on a beautiful sunny Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock when the sun's nice and high and there's not much of the lights, you know, at night don't really have this big positive impact on reducing traffic accidents. Maybe like in a few key spots they would, but in general, just like broadcasting like this broad spectrum light, like which now I can see from my city, it almost looks like there's like a forest fire or something on the horizon towards the highway. They've just lit it up. And the wild thing here is that they bought LEDs that are too bright, which have done two kind of completely ridiculous things. One is the lights were too bright when they were pointed down at the road. So they've had to actually point them now at 45 degrees. So they just shine off in all directions at 45 degrees. And they're huge lights. The other is these roads already had lights, many of them. And those old Cobra headlights are still there. But they don't even come on anymore because there's actually lights above them. So we have lights above lights. So these roads already had lights. And then they put in these even brighter lights. They pointed them down at first, but people were being just, you know, it was just too dazzling having these directly overhead. So instead of reducing the brightness of the lights, which would have been the smart thing to do, they've kept the brights at as high illuminance. Now they're just spilling it out, you know, into the surrounding neighborhood and people's windows and stuff like that. I can't believe that people haven't complained, but I guess people just suck it up. I'm about a mile away from them. And it's really quite ridiculously bright in my yard. I couldn't imagine the houses that are adjacent to these roads. It must just be wild. Like when you drive by them at night, like the places are just lit up. It's like living in a stadium really is what it's like everywhere now. It's like living in a stadium.
Right.
It's really strange.
Yeah. And that has to be, you know, some people may not even realize that they can speak up. They might mm-hmm. It might not even cross the mind. Again, that goes back to the way we talk about light. Often is as a solution to, well, it has many problems it can solve, right? It can make you be able to see where you're going. It can make you be able to see in the distance a little better. You know, there's many things it can solve, but it's not always a solution for everything. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution. You have to be deliberate with a light. And if we come at it from light, artificial light itself, changes the environment. It affects creatures living in the environment. Actually, probably affects people too, but it's a really hard case to make because we all close the shades and go to bed. And just in general, unless we have some good specific data on macular degeneration right into the eye from these new stadium lights, maybe will, because these things are so bright, that people put on the side of their apartment complexes and shops. You know, it's not an easy win, but there are studies out there that kind of hint at what it would be, right? Blue light, which includes these 4,000K temperature lamps. You know, blue light is not good when we're starting to do our nighttime cycle. That's why your phone changes to warm. That's why your Windows laptop will change to warm. Also, having bright light during the day is healthy, right? But then having dim to no light at night is better. you know, is healthy as well. It's both of them have to work in together, because that's a natural circadian rhythm, which we're part of. We have this, we live in this environment. So I think to your initial idea, Chris, where it's like, you know, people are just kind of sucking it up. They probably don't even know, because they probably never thought about it. They probably never had the thought that, oh, you know what, this actually could be affecting me, or could be affecting, you know, there's studies out there showing that earthworms don't like artificial light at night. So earthworms, which, and I'm not sure how much they are up in your area. Obviously they're invasive to North America, but, you know, we use them for everything. Right. And what they do is they aerate the soil and help, you know, plant growth and whatnot. And the earthworms don't want to be in artificial light, so they actually provide less aeration to soils. So it actually changes the soil consistency, which makes it, you know, difficult for the longevity of plants. The lights you're talking about right there, Chris, could potentially affect the growth pattern of trees and plants. So you're always on lights, or essentially stressing out. Some species will be very much all in favor of it, but other species will get stressed out by those lights, and it'll make them weaker, even though they look like they're getting stronger.
You know, what's really, really strange about that story that you just told is that at one of my observing sites when I lived in Ontario, because on Southern Ontario is fairly light polluted. One of my observing sites was, I don't know what you call it, but the place where they grow the earthworms, and then they would go and harvest them, because it was actually a fairly dark spot. I don't know if they had some sort of regional ordinance. We had no idea that that's what this place was, but we would just go out there and observe. It was pretty good, like, dark spot for Southern Ontario. And then one night we show up and they have like these giant special lights that they've erected. And I guess what they do at night is they put up I don't know what they do exactly, but they shine these lights down, and then it causes all the earthworms to come up and they go around and collect them. We're like, what is going? So we asked, and they were like, oh yeah, that's what this place is. So, you know, 99.9% of the time we go out there, it's a nice dark spot. And then every once in a while they would have this kind of thing set up. So for sure. Yeah. Those people who were raising the earthworms certainly knew that it needed to be a good, dark, pristine spot to raise them. But yeah, it's kind of scary. Hey, quick question though. Yep. One of the things, I think we're getting towards the end, but I wanted to ask about your thoughts on the Starlink and other satellite networks that are sort of beginning to light pollute in a whole different way. Have you done any shows on that? I got to imagine that you probably have.
Yeah, I've had John Berenstein on, who's a knowledgeable person in the realm of light pollution and astronomy. And it was back, I think it was May last year, where he was on and he was talking about these new satellites. And that's when the stories really started hitting big about the number of satellites we'll have. And I unfortunately don't have the number in front of me, so I don't want to quote the number that's projected out over the next six years.
But thousands and thousands.
It's pretty absurd.
Yeah.
Essentially, you'll have orbiting and deorbiting going on somewhat like daily.
Constantly.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a much tougher nut to crack. And, you know, I know Shane, you talked about pushing a rope up the hill. That's a serious rope you're pushing up the hill, because there's no unified government agency. Right. And that's all international, and that's all, you can kind of, you know, hope that they abide by some basic principles and can find a way to minimize the impact. But, you know, who's to say Russia or China would care much about that, or India cares much about that? You know, at least we can say, at least we're happy to the point that Starlink may not reduce the overall impact, but at least they try. And I feel like if we can keep moving that direction, that's better than nothing at the moment. You know, maybe there is a better solution out there through trying to learn how to minimize these impacts. And I know that they had a big statement release a couple months ago from one of the astronomical associations on how they're working directly to kind of bring this first and foremost on the international scene, and and they've received positive response from Starlink, so or from SpaceX. But that's a tough one, you know. It's
yeah, there's a lot out of our control there, and becomes a whole different level of influence to try to move the needle.
I think it's a little terrifying to envision the night moving, and that's kind of the future that we might have. So, and then you think about having those, like Chris, right? You have that many objects up there, and God forbid one of them crashes and then creates what the, I forget what it's called, the Kessler syndrome or whatever it is. Yeah. That'd be terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we're getting pretty close to the end here, Bill. Is there any final comments you'd like to leave with our listeners, or any questions for us even?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't think I have any questions for you guys, but it's good to hear, Chris, you know, the work you've been doing up there. I just want to say I'm incredibly jealous of your skies. Not jealous of the temperature up there, but jealous of the skies. And
that's fair. Yeah. Yeah. The skies here are wonderful. You know, certainly I've seen them deteriorate in the last 20 years since I've become more aware of the value of dark skies. You know, Chris said they're putting up lights all over the place on our highways, and, you know, our cities are expanding, and it is a problem for sure, but we are still pretty fortunate that we don't have to travel too far. And we have some really nice skies. So I'm hoping we can maintain some of that in this province, and really, you know, globally, you know, it's something that needs attention everywhere.
Yeah. I would say my thought on with someone, you know, some tips for people, right? Mm-hmm. Like if this is an issue that you feel is worth, you know, putting your boots on and going out there and trying to preserve our night, because we really are looking at, I don't want to be too extreme about it, but it does feel like the eradication of night. We're looking at trying to cut off a whole half of the day. And first, join Dark Sky International. They have a ton of different resources, and they can connect you with people, and they can connect you with people in your area. And it's going to be a learning curve. And that's why I put together Light Pollution News. The podcast is trying to help further discussion. And many of those discussion points are discussion points that you will have when you're going through your journey, you know, and just talk to people. And talk. And once you get to the point where you want to start really, if you want to do any advocacy or whatnot, find those allies. You know, here we have bird groups that are very much on board with having, you know, a day and a night. You know, there's ecological groups out there that will be on board. And maybe there's some health related groups in your area that might be, you know, might be in favor of trying to promote some responsible policies.
That sounds good to me. Bill, how can people find the Light Pollution News podcast?
Sure. You can find the show at wherever you listen to your podcast, or you can just go out to lightpollutionnews.com.
Anything to add to the show, Shane?
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for the chat, but probably more so, thanks for your advocacy. This is such an important topic that I don't think can get enough attention. And the more awareness you and others create around this, I think just the better humanity is, and really all of our ecosystems. And you can't overstate that enough, just how impactful this is. And, you know, I liked how you positioned this right at the start, that, you know, this is a ecological thing. You know, it's like any other pollution, and it's a problem, and we have to control it. And if we don't, we already have a problem on our hands. You know, we have to start to pull it in so that, you know, the future, so that the future isn't so bright, I guess. Mm-hmm. So anyway, just thank you for all of your advocacy, and certainly thank you for taking some time to come on the show. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Keep up the good work, guys. I love this show. This is, I think, filling a need. This is a show that really fills a need, a really great show. So thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate your kind words, and really appreciate you being on. I've listened to several of your episodes as well. I think if people enjoy this show and have an interest in the night sky, and you always have so many different and interesting guests. I did have a few questions for you in that. We'll have to save those for another day. But yeah, people should definitely check out the Light Pollution News podcast and listen to Bill and all the amazing guests that he's somehow magically able to get on. Dear listeners, please subscribe, share the show with other stargazers you know, and send us your show ideas, observations, and questions to actualastronomy@gmail.com.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you are interested in more information, would like to contact us, or if you would like to support the podcast, check out our website, actualastronomy.com.